Welcome, everybody, to another Baseball America podcast. I'm Connor Glassy. I'm joined with Nathan Rohde, and we have Jim Callis on Skype. The draft is over. It was a busy 3 days, a fun 3 days. Now we're all trying to recap and see what happened, figure out what happened over the last busy 3 days. This podcast is obviously brought to you by Dick's Sporting Goods. They sponsor all of our draft content on baseballamerica.com and had a great presence over the past month or so. So, Jim, you know, you're back in Chicago, is that right?
I am back home, finally. I kind of returning to the land of the living. First night I had a normal amount of sleep in a long time last night, and I feel vaguely human again this morning.
Well, good. First off, why don't you just tell our listeners what it's like to go out to New Jersey and be a part of the MLB Network broadcast for the draft?
I enjoy that every year. I mean, it's always interesting because it's obviously I'd be doing a lot more at baseballamerica.com if I wasn't doing MLB Network, but I love being part of that broadcast. And I guess what sticks out the most for me, and this is the fourth year they've done it, is how much everybody there is really geared up for the draft, too. I mean, you got Greg Amsinger, who's kind of the traffic cop at the desk there on the main set, and Greg loves his stuff. I mean, Greg will sit there. You know, obviously, I think at Baseball America, we dig into the draft deeper than everybody else, and we do these state-by-state reports and all these scouting reports. And Greg will ask me about some guy, hey, who's ranked, you know, number 162 on the BA 500 about some nugget he read. And, you know, Harold Reynolds, you know, has a ton of enthusiasm. And, you know, John Hart brings that kind of veteran presence of a guy who's been in the draft room. And those guys, I'll be honest, are as geared up for the draft as we are at Baseball America. You know, Matt Yaloff, who I do the touchscreen stuff with, is great. And you know, we're talking on air a lot during the show, but we're also talking a lot off air just about stuff that's going on. And it's just very, very exciting. And I thought that I'd be curious to see what you guys thought of this, you know, watching the broadcast. I thought this year there was more electricity than ever. You had five players there, you know, including the number one pick in Carlos Correa, you know, who nobody saw coming really as the number one pick. We knew he was in the discussion. So that was a terrific moment. You have Courtney Hawkins doing his backflip, you know, right there in on the stage. And then you even had, you know, they got CC Sabathia to come in and be the Yankees' official draft dignitary. That room, there was more electricity, I thought, there at the broadcast than there had been for any of the previous five broadcasts, either on ESPN or MLB Network.
Yeah, no, I absolutely agree. I mean, getting all the players there is great. I hope that number continues to grow. The backflip, I'm sure, scared the crap out of the White Sox, but it was really fun to watch. I mean, I've had the pleasure of seeing that in person, as you can see on Baseball America's YouTube channel. I got to watch Courtney do that in person, and I was nervous when he told me he was going to do it at the NHSI, you know, this spring.
On the concourse.
I was like,
if he slips, he's getting hurt. So.
I was like, hey, do you want to go to the grass? And he was like, no, I got this. I'm like, oh, I was really nervous to watch it, but it was a cool moment. It was even better to see with, you know, in a three-piece suit there flipping on the set. But, yeah, no, I definitely agree. I think there was a lot more energy, and I think baseball fans in general are kind of starting to appreciate the draft more because it's maybe a little more evident to casual fans how quickly, you know, a top draft pick can impact a team.
Yeah, I agree. You know, and I was going to say, the other thing that always sticks out to me about the MLB Network broadcast is the difficult thing, and I think they do this well, is it's tough. You have to serve kind of two masters there. You have to serve the hardcore draft fan who, you know, is a fan of Baseball America and, you know, wants to know who's going in the fifth round. And you have to serve the casual fan who is just, you know, maybe he's a fan of a specific team and wants to know who their first round pick is and really has no clue who any of these guys are. You kind of have to walk that line, and I think they do a very good job of it. I hope I'm not sounding like a shill, but I honestly believe they put so much work into trying to serve both those masters and so much work into trying to get players there, and it really paid off this year. And I think they'll have a bit easier time getting players in the future. You know, it's always going to be hard getting college players because the NCAA playoffs are going on at the same time. You know, they were able to get Andrew Heaney this year because Oklahoma State didn't get a regional bid. But I think if I'm a high school player, you know, there are four guys there. Everybody had a pretty good time this year, and I think they're going to have an easier time getting high school players going forward.
Yeah, absolutely. Jim, you know, you mentioned that during the broadcast, you're in a different studio, is that right? But did you have a chance to meet any of the players or anything like that?
A little bit. They were staying at the same hotel I was at. You know, and we're off in a set where they do like intentional talk and the rundown, and it's a different studio, so you don't intermingle. I did meet Andrew Heaney's parents at my hotel the next day. I did run into Courtney Hawkins the day of the draft when he was getting ready to go over to MLB Network. And it was funny. I asked him where he thought he was going to go, and he was kind of nervous. I mean, knew he was going to go good, but still kind of nervous. Wasn't sure exactly where he was going. I said, I think you're going 13 to the White Sox. And then when I saw him later after the draft, I said, hey, I told you 13 to the White Sox. He's like, you did. So you got to see those guys a little bit too.
Nice. Well, let's talk about the first round. I mean, you mentioned Correa was a little bit of a surprise there at the top. Although, you know, I don't think it was a bad pick. I think it was actually a good pick for the Astros. What do you think?
I do. And, you know, the thing was, and I think we tried to convey this, I mean, both at, on the broadcast and at Baseball America. This wasn't a pick made because of money. This wasn't we're selling for a lesser guy. We actually had Carlos Correa ranked ahead of Mark Appel when we did our final rankings. We revised our top 50 for MLB Network the day of the draft. He was a legitimate talent pick. I also think it was advantageous for the Astros because it was weird with Correa. I mean, you're talking about a guy who gets compared to Troy Tulowitzki, maybe even A-Rod. I mean, five-tool shortstop, bigger-bodied guy but could probably stay at the position. Great workouts down the stretch. He was in the mix literally for every team from 1 to 7. Every one of those teams was thinking about him. But if he didn't go 1, he was going 7. He was literally like the plan B or plan C for all these other teams. And I really think if he didn't go 1, he was going 7. So the other advantage for Houston was they got a guy who legitimately belonged in that number 1 spot. There was no Steven Strasburg, no Bryce Harper. But they also got a guy who was probably willing to give them a bigger discount on the $7.2 million allotted for that pick in their bonus pool than the other players. I mean, the word is he's going to sign, I think, for somewhere around $5 million, maybe even a little bit less than that. When we saw them come back in the sandwich round and take Lance McCullers, you know, and I think they're still going to have money left over after those two picks. But I think it was a great pick from a talent standpoint. And I will also say, I know I'm rambling here, the Astros did something that I thought was very, very smart, and I don't think anybody anticipated this. They didn't really engage any of the players or any of the advisors until right before the draft. And they had a mix. They kept saying, we're looking at 5 people. I really think it was more – I mean, they were probably looking at 5, but I think realistically you were talking Mark Appel, Byron Buxton, Carlos Correa in whatever order. And they didn't really engage any of those guys until right before the draft. So they really kind of took any – I don't know if it's leverage or just comfort zone, but these guys didn't, you know, have much time to make up their mind when the Astros said, look, okay, we're thinking about picking you. What parameters are we looking at? We don't like those parameters. You know, what do you think? There was not a lot in back and forth negotiating going on with these guys, and it really kind of gave the Astros the upper hand. It made it difficult for the teams behind the Astros, but it really gave the Astros, I thought, the upper hand with the guys they were talking with.
Sure. Okay. Nathan, what stood out for you in the first round? Were there any big surprises for you after Correa?
Well, I think, you know, certainly the falling of Appel was interesting to kind of see that unfold. It's always, you know, intriguing to watch the draft and see, you know, we know who the guys are and we rank them on talent. And, you know, it was supposed to go a little more true to talent this year, you know, with the new rules and things like that. And I think in a way it did, like we've talked about, you know, the first 8 guys, while they didn't go in order, there was a pretty clear-cut 8 guys, and they all went in that first 8. And after that, you know, things unfolded as they should. But, you know, watching McCullers also kind of come down a little bit, and then the Astros being able to get him at 41 overall after getting a guy like Correa, you know, I found that pretty interesting. And like Jim said, you know, Correa isn't a money pick, but they are able to save some money there on him, which then they can turn around and give to McCullers too, which obviously would be a coup for them. If you just sign those top 2 guys, that's a pretty good draft. Not to mention they did, you know, take some other guys throughout that do have very interesting upside. You know, and then we'll talk strategy later when JJ comes on. But, you know, taking those easier signs, you know, in the like 5 to 10, 6 to 10 round range, and then they go and pop a guy like Hunter Verant, you know, with the first pick in the 11th round. You know, if they have extra money left over, they might be able to throw it at him. But if they don't, you know, there's no penalty because he's a post 10th round pick. So just kind of seeing that specifically unfold, and then just watching it with these new rules in mind, kind of how everything played out. Was certainly very interesting for me.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, for me, you know, the Appel thing is interesting because on one hand, you know, I think people are surprised, you know, because he was kind of a top rated guy all throughout the spring. But on the other hand, I think it also you know, there's a point to be made that he was almost the number one by default. I mean, this class was a little bit underwhelming. There wasn't that, you know, slam dunk 1-1 guy like Bryce Harper or Steven Strasburg in the past. So Mark Appel was number, you know, he was the top guy for us on some of our lists throughout the spring. But you can make an argument that, you know, some of these other guys were just as good as him.
Absolutely.
So the fact that he went eighth, I mean, it's not it was a little bit of a surprise, but it's not a complete shock. Would you agree with that, Jim?
I would, and I think there was something else that worked here, too. With these new rules, teams, you had these new rules and you had these pool amounts and assigned values for each pick. I think everybody agreed, you know, starting at the top, first pick is worth $7.2 million in the CBA, but there's not a $7.2 million player in this year's draft. And I think everybody, all the teams I talked to, almost every team in the first round, no matter where they were picking, said, look, our number is higher than the value of the player we're going to get there. I mean, you're going to see a couple guys get more. They're high school guys who maybe slid and are going to use college leverage. But in general, for the talent you're talking about, these numbers were too high. And so as a result, you had teams engaging players, and it was more difficult because you didn't know exactly who Houston was going to pick. But at the top of the draft, you had teams engaging players, hammering out what that number was going to be. I mean, you're going to see – I think you're going to see probably at least a $2 million discount on Correa with the number one pick from his pick value. You could see $1.5 million discounts on the next couple picks with Buxton and Zunino, you know, or probably not as much on Buxton, but I think Zunino could be at least $1 million under the 5.2. We're going to see some steep discounts, and that money's getting reapplied. And so teams not only were engaging the players and trying to figure out exactly what it was going to take money-wise, then they're figuring out, okay, now we have the savings. How are we going to spend it elsewhere in the draft? So teams were plotting out their strategy well before. I mean, nobody knew Correa was going number one, really, until I don't think a lot of teams probably didn't find out for sure until the draft began. So you have your draft strategy, you know, plotted out. We're saving X amount here in the first round, then we're going to, you know, spend it here. Here's a guy who can fall, that type of thing. And I think what happened when Appel didn't go number one, there were probably teams, and I'm sure everybody will insist, hey, you know, we liked player X more than Appel, and that's why we took him. At the same time, in my heart, I do believe there were teams who liked Mark Appel talent-wise better than the guys they took in the first round. But you didn't have time to react. You had 5 or 10 minutes to, you know, his advisor is the Boris Corporation, which I think everybody knows. You know, you had 5 or 10 minutes to engage the Boris Corporation and try to figure out exactly what you're going to sign him for, which is going to be impossible. And in lieu of doing that, it's almost easier. Okay, we know we can get this other guy that we've already talked to for X and do our plan. If we get Appel, we don't have that cost certainty, and it might affect what we can do elsewhere. So I think the rules played a part in Mark Appel sliding as well. In some cases, it was easier to take the guy you had already kind of had some discussions with and were able to, you know, plan accordingly.
Absolutely. Jim, who was your favorite pick later on in the first round? You know, a guy that you thought was a great pick later, you know, in the back half of the first round? Or on the flip side, who was the most surprising player that didn't go in the first round for you?
Well, I think the guy, I mean, you guys heard me rant about him a little bit on the MLB Network broadcast. I love Marcus Stroman's arm. I think the guy can get to the big leagues very quickly this year, and then you could try to maybe make him a starter next year. I thought Marcus Stroman should have gone the first, you know, 10, 12 picks, and he went 22 to the Jays. And it's great for the Jays. The Jays are contending. He can help their bullpen this year. I also thought, you know, in the first round specifically, I thought Michael Wacha lasted longer than I thought. You know, and both Michael Wacha and Chris Stratton, I thought were going to go at the, you know, before the teens, and they went 19 and 20. And then Ty Hensley, I thought, you know, if you take out, you know, Max Fried's the best high school pitcher in this draft, and with Lucas Giolito hurt, and with Lance McCullers costing a lot of money, you know, I thought Ty Hensley was like the second most appealing high school pitcher to a lot of teams, and I was kind of surprised he lasted 30 picks.
You nailed my two guys. All three of them, actually. I had Stroman, Wacha, and Hensley on there.
I was going to say Stroman, too, but, you know, I'm okay with him going to the Blue Jays since I do that organization's top 30, and my scouting report for him is already written.
There you go.
There you go.
What about a team that stands out overall, Jim? Who do you like there? Just pick one so we can each get one in here.
Yeah, I won't steal it. But, well, I'll stick with the Blue Jays. I thought, you know, they had extra picks, and I think we see this a lot. It's always easy to love the extra pick teams, you know, immediately after the draft to get more of the top talent. But, I mean, you got DJ Davis to pick 17, who's one of the best athletes in the draft. You know, very, you know, good spot to get him in. They stole Marcus Stroman at 22. A lot of guys thought he had the most electric arm in the draft. They come back at pick 50, and they get Matt Smorl, Ohio High School left-hander, who was an easy mid-first-round pick until he broke a bone in his foot. Shouldn't affect him long-term, But, you know, and I think, you know, again, if he went that high, my guess is they figured out a way to sign him. And they had two more sandwich picks. They got Mitch Ney, who's a third baseman from Arizona, who was really rising up draft boards as the draft got closer. They got Tyler Gonzalez, who reminds me a little bit of Marcus Stroman in that he has just two really electric pitches, high school pitcher from Texas. And the one, you know, Chase DeJong, you know, good high school pitcher from California, second round. Then the third round, the one I'll be interested to see if they can pull off, they got Anthony Alford, who probably rivals DJ Davis as the best, you know, and Byron Buxton as the best all-around athletes in this draft. I don't know if they can sign him away from Southern Miss football, you know, Southern Miss football recruit. But if they can, I mean, you're talking, you know, that's an incredible amount of talent with those seven guys in the first three rounds.
No doubt. How about you, Nathan?
Well, I like what the Astros did. You know, obviously the pick with Correa was a little bit of a surprise, but he certainly was in the discussion for that number one. And, you know, you can't ignore what he could potentially bring to the to that organization. But then also taking advantage of that, they're going to have a little bit extra money there to go for McCullers, like we've talked about. But then they didn't back down after that, really. You know, Nolan Fontana might be, you know, an easier sign, but he's by no means, you know, one of those senior sign guys out there where they tried to go really cheap. But in the fourth round, a personal favorite of mine with Rio Ruiz, you know, Mitch missed much of the season because of a blood clot in his shoulder. And, you know, it's still kind of up in the air when he's going to be back on the field. But, you know, he's a really strong third baseman. I think he can really handle the bat and hit for some power. And you know, then John Manuel favorite and Brett Phillips in the sixth round. You know, if you can save some money elsewhere, you might be able to sign him out of his commitment. And then, you know, kind of the answer to our question is why all these, you know, senior signs are going to sixth to tenth round. Hunter Verant, first pick in the 11th round. If you got some money left over, you can make a run at him late, you know, right before the signing period. But if you don't sign them, you don't lose any money for it, and you can spread it out amongst your first 10-round guys. So I really like the approach and like the fact that, you know, while they did save some money, they didn't go extremely cheap. They still did go for some guys with some upside.
Sure. Yeah, absolutely.
I think the way they drafted all those seniors, I think there's a very good chance, and I think they're going to save money at the top with the Correa-McCullers combo. I don't think it's going to cost the whole $8.5 million for those two picks. I think there's a chance they sign everybody in the first 10 rounds, including Ruiz and Phillips, and maybe even pull off Ferrant. I think they have structured this where they have a very good chance to sign each one of those guys.
I agree. Absolutely.
It would be fascinating. I guess Correa has taken BP at Minute Maid today. I'd love to be able to see that. But me personally, you know, I really liked what the Cardinals did, but they are another team with extra picks. So I'll go with a team that had just, you know, their regular allotment of picks. I like what the Indians did. I mean, Jim, you know, you probably think that Naquin went a little higher than he should. I love Tyler Naquin. I think, you know, he's one of the best pure bats in this year's draft, and 15 might be a little rich for them. But then after him, I like the high school upside guys they got with Mitch Brown, Kieran Lovegrove, and Devon McClure. I mean, I think this is a really nice top five here for the Indians.
Yeah, and I'd throw Schubert in the seventh round, a Hamrick in the eighth round into the high school upside group as well. And they got Dylan Baker, you know, a JUCO pitcher there in round five, who a lot of people thought had a chance at one point to go in the first couple rounds. I agree. They kind of took a different approach. You know, I don't think they took a bunch of super discount guys in rounds 1 through 10, but they kind of took, in some ways, you know, best available player with each pick. And I think they have a chance to sign most of those guys too.
Yeah. Okay. Well, let's Nathan and I will step aside. We'll let J.J. Cooper come in here, and you guys can talk a little bit about, you know, some of the strategic moves of this year's draft.
Okay, sounds good.
We're back here on the Baseball America podcast. This is J.J. Cooper. I've joined in here. And if you are just interested in the analysis of the players and kind of what teams got what, you can turn off the podcast now. But if you are interested in what happened with the new CBA and some of the effects of the new rules, that's what we're going to kind of dive into now. And I don't know about you, Jim. To me, this was the most different draft I can ever remember because of the new rules. Did it strike you as we saw things happening in a different way than we'd ever seen before?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I think at the top of the draft, you had, you know, with these pick values assigned to each pick in the first 10 rounds, I think most teams felt like the first round pick values were higher than the actual value of the players. Like if you had an open market, most guys would not command the full pick value. And I think they set them, I think MLB and the MLBPA set them artificially high so the teams at the top would have a lot more money to play with and theoretically could land more talent in the draft. But the thing you had going on at the top was, instead of in the past where you had these artificially low slots that were determined just by MLB and teams kind of realizing, hey, we're going to have to negotiate up from a lot of these, in most cases now in the first round, you were negotiating down from the pool number. And then because you have a strict limit on what you could do budget-wise in the first 10 rounds without incurring severe penalties with draft picks, after you get past the first, you know, two or three rounds, a lot of the high school guys were just, you know, going to be impossible to sign. And I think, and I know we're going to talk about this in more detail, I think everybody knew, okay, round 6 through 10, you're going to see some college seniors taken to create some money. I don't think anybody thought it was going to be to the extreme it was. I certainly didn't. It just seemed like it was, especially the last two rounds, rounds 9 and 10, it seemed like almost half the players were college seniors in those rounds.
I want to jump on first. I'm talking about the first round where you made the point about how it is true that in the past, MLB had set these artificially low slots for first-round picks where it was notable if you did sign a player at slot because most players weren't going to sign for slot. There was guys who were considered slot picks for that and a lot of other guys who it's like, okay, the negotiations are going to start well above the what supposedly is the slot for that pick. With the new rules, what jumps out to me is at the very top end of the draft, the gradations are so severe that it actually puts a lot of leverage in the hands of the teams. The first pick, $7.2 million. The second pick, $6.2 million. By pick five, you're talking several million dollars less than what you could get at pick one. So that allows, if you have a draft like this one, where there was no player, if you have a Bryce Harper or someone like that in the draft, it doesn't give you the team that much leverage because it's not, well, we could take this guy or we could take that guy. But in a draft like this one, it did, I think, give teams a lot of leverage because if you're the Astros at pick number one and you say, you like Carlos Correa, you like Mark Appel, you like a couple of other guys, you can go to those guys and kind of see which one is willing to take significantly less than 7.2 because if you're a player like Carlos Correa who could go one or could have gone seven or eight, the difference in slot allotment, if you'd end up going at pick eight, the allotment's $2.9 million. The allotment at number one is 7.2. Well, even if you end up getting 5.5 or $6 million, you're still doing way better than you'd have done if you'd have fallen in the draft. That, I think, gives the teams at the very top end of the draft the drop from pick one to pick five. Pick five is worth half, less than half of what pick one is. That, to me, draft in, draft out, is going to give teams a lot of leverage if there isn't a clear number one. What do you think about that?
I totally agree, and I think they had some leverage with Correa specifically because, you know, going through all the machinations and scenarios, what was going to go on the first round, I think Correa legitimately was in the mix for every team from one to seven. But I fully believe, and I know as much as you can know, if Mark Appel went number one, Carlos Correa was going to go number seven. He just wound up being the second choice for a lot of teams, and they were going to go in a different direction. And you're right, it does give you leverage. I think also what happened, too, with Appel is when Appel didn't go one, because teams were trying to take advantage of the leverage you were speaking about, JJ, and trying, and they also, on the same hand, were squeezed by a finite budget. You couldn't go over a certain number without losing draft picks. The Astros waited to really engage the guys they were looking at until right before the draft. They didn't let the players or the advisors, do a lot of negotiating or posturing. It was more, okay, short amount of time, and we're willing to go in a different direction, I guess, if you aren't willing to go with what we like for your individual player. Well, the teams behind them couldn't wait and just figure out, okay, well, now we know who the Astros are picking at 7-10 on draft day. We'll figure that out in 5 minutes. I think the teams had really engaged a lot of the players who were going to go at the top of the first round, figuring out exactly what the number was going to be in most cases, and then saying, okay, if we save $700,000 here, then we can put it into this pick and take this player when we get to that point. And so I think another strategy thing to happen is then when Mark Appel, who, we had as the third best player in this draft, I think he was better than the eighth best player in the draft, obviously, but at the same time, there was kind of that top tier of eight or so players who were going to be the top eight picks. I think what really happened is after he didn't go number one, the other teams had already gone far enough down the road with other players, knew exactly what those guys in most cases were going to cost. I already started plotting what's our strategy for the sandwich round, the second round, where can we use the savings, that you also ran out of time. at that point, I mean, and I'm sure every team, JJ, will say, hey, we got the guy we wanted. We like this guy better than Appel, you know, at pick X. But at the same point, I'm sure some of those teams had Appel higher than some of those guys on their board. But, you know, in 10 minutes is not enough time to all say, hey, Mark Appel is available. Let's see what he's going to cost. Well, you're not going to be able to pin that down with any certainty, and then you're not going to know what you're going to be able to do for the rest of the draft.
Right. I think the better way to put it, you're right. They're all going to say that this was our guy we wanted, you know, absolutely. The reality of it is, though, is that the better way to put it is this at the price that we knew we could get this guy, we'd rather get this guy and the certainty that we had for the rest of our draft rather than the uncertainty that comes with Mark Appel. The reality is that if you're the Pirates at 8, you land a better talent than you probably expected you're going to get at 8. The interesting thing now, that's going to be the most interesting negotiation going forward to the July 13th deadline. But what stands out to me is to me, it's pretty clear the Pirates hold almost all the cards as I see it, because Mark Appel is not going to get – I'll make that proclamation right now. Mark Appel's not going to get $6 million. It's not going to happen.
I don't think – I think it's going to be very, very hard unless the Pirates are – well, put it this way. I don't think the Pirates are going to take a draft pick penalty. I don't think anybody's going to take a draft pick penalty.
I don't think Mark Appel's worth taking a draft pick penalty.
Yeah, I wouldn't. I mean, I like Mark Appel. I think he's a good value. Get him with 8th pick in the draft. But you have no guarantee with the Pirates how the season's going to play out. And you might be throwing away the 10th pick in next year's draft. And I don't like that risk. But what I was going to say is, you know, you look at the other guys they took in the draft, you know, high up. Barrett Barnes in the sandwich round. Wyatt Mathis in the second round. John Sanford in the third round. I don't think those guys are going to be deep discount guys. I mean, they have some discount guys in rounds 6 through 10 that they can sign a little bit cheaper, but I was kind of eyeballing this earlier. You know, I think you can get Mark Appel to $3.5, $4 million, you know, by doing some of your discount stuff in the rest of the round, but I don't think you can, you know, their whole pool for the first 10 rounds is $6.6 million, and you're not going to give him, you know, 80% of that. I think it's kind of, to me, looking at this just from the outside, it looks to me kind of like a $4 million max.
And the thing to me is that if you're the Pirates, what you do now, to me, to add leverage is you go and lock up Barnes, you lock up Matheson, you lock up Sanford, you lock up those guys to where you go into those negotiations with Mark Appel saying, look, here's the maximum number. You can do the math like we do. And if you take it, great. If you don't, you can go back into next year's draft, okay? Because the reality is for the Pirates, the way the system is set up now, that's not a nightmare scenario. Because
no, and that pick's protected an extra year as well.
Right.
And now
the
picks are protected for 2 years.
That pick's protected for 2 years. So let's say that they end up with the 10th pick in next year's draft. Well, that would give them, say, 9 and 10 in next year's draft. Well, if they end up with that, they would also have a massive allotment for next year, which would give them the flexibility to either – sign a, you know, go out. They could do what the Blue Jays tried to do this year, where you end up drafting a lot of high upside, a little bit more expensive guys that you have to save money to do. Well, the Pirates could do that. The Pirates could say, take two guys at 9 and 10 who they can sign for significantly less than the $6 million or so allotment they'd have for those two picks, and use that money saved to kind of filter down the rest of the draft. Or if a guy next year falls in the draft who is a top talent, who you say, okay, you know, it's probably going to take $4.5 million to sign this guy, they could take that guy at 9 or 10 and use the extra allotment they have to kind of move money around to do that. So they will have kind of, if they don't get Appel this year, it's not necessarily a nightmare scenario for them, because it just means, okay, next year that gives us multiple guys to choose from.
Yeah, and the other thing they did too, they kind of covered themselves with Appel also. And, you know, like I said, I think they can kind of shift money around here. You know, I haven't crunched every bonus, what it's going to be here for them in the first 10 rounds. And they could probably create an extra $750,000 to $1 million for Mark Appel. Well, let's say Mark Appel won't sign for around $4 million. And I have no idea what's going to happen in the end there. But let's say he turns it down. Their 14th round pick, Walker Buehler, was ranked 50th on the BA 500. He's a guy who's committed to Vanderbilt. I think his price tag's right around $1 million. So you could take that money you've created for Mark Appel.
That's $700,000, $800,000 you have.
Yeah. And if he doesn't want it, you know, maybe it's $900,000. You could probably get to $1 million for Walker Buehler if you don't give the extra money to Mark Appel. And, you know, yeah, would you like Mark Appel? Yes. But if I don't sign Mark Appel, I still sign Walker Buehler, which is like having an extra sandwich pick, and I essentially trade Mark Appel for Walker Buehler and the ninth overall pick in next year's draft. So I think they did a nice job after round 10 of covering themselves with the guy like, look, if we have all this money burning a hole in a pocket and it's still not enough for Mark Appel, we can go get Walker Buehler rather than just have, you know, $900,000 we can't really spend.
And that's the thing. That's the one of the key points I wanted to get across on this. I know there was some confusion during the draft that people were like, well, you can't. There was a lot of thought out there that you can't sign a guy after the 10th round for more than $100,000, which is not true in any way, shape, or form. Actually, that may have been what MLB hoped, you know, kind of be the effect from this. But actually, what's happened is that you can sign a guy for after the 10th round for over $100,000. Again, if you've saved money in your top 10 rounds to put a little money aside, because any money you spend over $100,000 on a bonus on a guy after the 10th round counts towards your bonus allotment. But the interesting thing with that is we'll get into this later, is that that actually gives you a free $100,000 to play with on some of those guys. But
right.
But the thing that jumps out to me also about this is that what we saw under the old system is that the signing, the deadline, which ended up being August 15th, which was way too late, but the deadline put the pressure on the teams. That gave leverage for the players' advisors or agents in some cases, because some of them, you know, were definitely going pro. But that gave them leverage to kind of help push drive the price up. I really think what you're going to see this year, and you're already seeing a little bit of, is the leverage now, because there's a fixed amount of money, the leverage has shifted back to the teams, because I tweeted about this yesterday. Let's say that you took, you're not the Pirates in this example, but another team, let's say you took a couple of high school guys who are going to be difficult signs, but guys who, if they get the right paycheck, you know, the right bonus, they're going to seriously consider going pro. If you drafted, say, three of those guys, and you set aside $400,000, $450,000 that you had saved up from your top 10 rounds, it's pretty simple for you to go to those three guys and say, look, let's spell this out. We like you. We want to sign you. First guy who says yes to 450, it's his. Once that's done, it's gone. You don't have a choice. And so all of a sudden, you are putting the impetus on the player making a quick decision rather than it coming down to the very end. And it's like, okay, you're going to lose this guy if you don't make this decision now. Before, the pot of money was in some ways unlimited. It was limited by the team's budget, but that wasn't a fixed number that everyone knew. Now, in many cases, it is a fixed number that people know. So every time someone signs, that's more money coming out of that pool. And so as the clock keeps ticking, there's going to be less and less money in that pool for a player to take.
You know, I mean, it's, you know, you hit the nail on the head. I mean, last year, I mean, you did have budgets, and teams, you know, every team had a budget of what they could spend, and sometimes there was some wiggle room. But, you know, if I'm negotiating with a player under the old rules, you know, let's say I'm negotiating with you, JJ, and you're advising a guy, I can say, you know, you could give me a number, and I could say, well, you know, I can't do that. And you can come back and say, well, you can do it. It's just a matter of wanting to do it, or my guy walks. Now I can say, JJ, I can't go over $300,000, or I've got $500,000 left in my draft budget, or else I lose a first-round pick, and we're not going to lose a first-round pick. You know, it's, you know, I think more players will walk away than sign in the past because they'll run out of money. I think two things are going to happen with signings. I think we're going to see a ton of guys announced in the next 7 to 10 days who agreed to below-budget deals because the teams – here's the scary thing. I had a couple guys tell me this yesterday. If you're a team and you've negotiated or agreed to a below-budget number for a player, whether it's a guy in the first round or a guy in the 10th round, you're signing for $5,000, you can't move forward on your over-budget guys until you get those guys locked up on paper. So right now – yeah, there's a little – I mean, I think everybody thinks everybody will honor their agreements. I'm sure a couple will blow up for whatever reason. But those are – you know, people want to get guys signed. If you've agreed to me for below budget, I want you signed now so I can move forward. So I think you'll have those guys done.
Oh.
I do think you'll have the expensive guys in some cases. You'll have – I still think we'll have a decent amount of guys who go to the deadline because they've been educated in the past. The longer you wait, the more money that will be there. And while that may not be true this year, I do think – you're going to have some players waiting to see, you know, how far will a team go. Let's wait till July 13th and find out.
And one other thing with that is that you're the funny thing is if you're one of these seniors who was drafted in the 6th, 7th, 8th round and all, basically you're not getting – I mean, We're hearing four-digit bonuses. We're hearing
right, probably it could be $5,000.
$5,000. Now the interesting thing is that if you have no scruples, and I'm not advising anyone to do this, but the leverage, the only leverage that a player like that has, is if you have no scruples and are willing to go back on your word, that's the one nightmare scenario for a team. Is if you draft one of those guys and he says he's going to sign for five, and then you bring him the contract and he goes, you know what, I don't know if I'm going to sign for five. That's the time that they have leverage, because the reality is that the player himself is less valuable than the money that is saved by signing him. Am I right?
Yeah, no, you're right. I mean,
I don't think many players are going to do this, because here's the reality. Again, the player is less valuable than the pick. So, okay, yeah, you may get a couple of extra $1,000 out of them, and you're done. you're buried in wherever, and you're going to have to basically hit $1,000 to ever get a chance to do anything in that organization, because already what you've established to them is they can't trust you. So,
yeah, and I was going to say, too, if that player – I mean, not, some of these guys actually have advisors, some of these college seniors around 6 through 10. You know, maybe they were a higher-profile draft guy in the past and had an advisor or whatever. I think if you have an advisor, the advisor's going to say, look, they're going to counsel against it. You know, if you're just kind of a lone wolf with no advisor and you try to do that, I mean, the team, like you said, JJ, is going to be very angry. They're not going to give you, like, $125,000.
No.
And you're exactly right.
They'll eat that money if they have to, but they're
because that's the thing. If you're asking me for 50 and I thought I was giving you 5, I'm just going to say, you know what, dude, you're not getting signed. And, you know, and believe me, teams talk. That guy's going to have to go to independent ball and hit a ton or throw great to get another chance. They'll just be like, you're done.
Yeah,
we don't have any interest.
You're going to be blackballed throughout baseball. I mean,
But you're right. I mean, I suggested JJ coming in to avoid that kind of shenanigans and to avoid this mockery of round 6 through 10 that went on. What I think they should have done, I think they should tweak the rules, and maybe they will going forward. I understand why if you don't sign a guy, the money has to disappear in rounds 1 through 3. Because, I mean, this is an extreme example, but if I'm the Astros, let's say I don't sign the number one pick and I have $7.2 million there. Well, I would get the number two pick in next year's draft, which would be $6.2 million. And then if the money didn't disappear, I could spread the 7.2 around this year. So I could basically double my money. So I understand you can't have that. It would be, like, way too goofy. But rounds 4 through 10, you don't get a compensation pick. So if I don't sign a guy, I don't get the pick back next year. I think they should have just told the teams, rounds 4 through 10, that money is yours to spend. You do whatever you want. You don't have to sign the guys. And you're not even talking about a big difference. The Astros have the top pick each round. Round 4 through 10, you add it up, it's $1.3 million. The Phillies have the last pick in each round. You add up their 4 through 10, it's $1.1 million. And I think the draft would have been maybe a little bit more truer to talent, and you would have avoided some of this goofiness if you could have just told people, do what you want with that money. You don't have to sign your 8th-round pick for $5,000 to save $130,000.
Well, how about this? Just take away the whole, it counts for your top 10 rounds. Basically, going forward, say after the third round, like you said, it's going to be a $1.2 to $1.3 million allotment. You have $1.2 to $1.3 million to spend on the rest of your draft, and any player in any round who costs more than $100,000 counts towards that.
Yeah, I see what you're saying. See, I could sign like my 4th rounders through 40th rounders for $100,000, and I get $1.3 to play with is like extra money to give them or to give my first round.
Which,
yeah, that would be fine too. Sure.
Which the reality is MLB is probably not going to want to do that, because what MLB doesn't want, it seems like, they're concerned about both, but they really don't want teams having that extra million to pay a top talent in the first or second round. Right.
Well, they're going to have it. I mean, the thing is, the teams are going to have it. They're just doing it by signing their 6th or 10th round picks for combined $25,000.
Right.
To me,
that solution, if you do that, it basically you eliminate this artificialness of, okay, well, actually 6th rounders are not as talented as 11th rounders, but you do the same thing, because if you do it that way, you have to have that gradation where your protected picks, the picks that you're going to get another pick for, this does not apply to. Those have specific slots, and if you don't sign them, you lose that money. But beyond, I was going to say, beyond that, it seems like you don't really gain anything by saying it's this artificial 4th through 10th round rule, and after that, it's a different rule.
Well, you know what I realized, and you're right, the reason MLB wouldn't do your rule, JJ, is it would basically give teams an extra $700,000 to play with in rounds 4 through 10. You know, you'd get the 1.3 to do what you want, your extra money, but you'd also get $100,000 max to spend in rounds 4 through 10. And so that would be an extra, like, about $700,000 per team. And when all is said and done, these draft rules are going to save teams a million and a half. And so that would wind up resulting, if you went to your more liberal rule, that would wind up resulting in saving about half as much money as they're going to save in the first place. So we probably won't see something quite that liberal.
But that's where the other thing that jumped out to me. So, I mean, obviously the big effect from this is that we saw a lot of seniors, and you mentioned it. I think in a lot of cases, one of the selling points was, you know, the selling points that teams were looking for, scouts were looking for, A, are you a senior with no leverage? B, do you have some kind of tool of some sort that you're at least semi-interesting? Because, you know, everyone who has taken, it seems like that we've at least tracked down who has taken from really off boards in those 5th through 10th rounds had at least something that was fringy, you know, major league average, hopefully. But I think the third part is either do you have an advisor who understands what's going on here, or do you not have an advisor? Because I really think that the biggest tool for all these guys who were being drafted there was scouts could trust that they were going to sign and that they were they understood the situation and were willing to sign. Because, hey, the reality is I know some people listening may wonder, why would a guy agree to this deal and, you know, the slot's $130,000 and you agreed to $5,000? A lot of these guys who were taken 6th through 10th round didn't even know if they were going to be drafted, is what's crazy.
Yeah, or might get drafted in the 30th round and you're looking at 5. This way you know you're getting picked. And, you know, the thing is, I think in some ways, if I'm a team picking one of these guys, well, one, I think a lot of these guys are the guys who usually go in the 20th or 30th round where you're throwing some area scout who maybe hasn't had a player pick yet. Hey, you know, who's your gut feel guy we can sign for $5,000? And I think that's what teams did. Hey, round 6 through 10, who's a guy you kind of like that we can sign super, super cheap? But I think the other thing is, in some ways, if some of these guys had advisors who the teams know and trust, that's almost better than not having an advisor. Because even if you think the kid's a great kid, you don't know. The parents get involved. The dad may say, you know what, look, we owe $100,000 towards college money. You see if they'll give you $25,000. You're almost better off getting a respected advisor you've worked with and you know you can deal with that says, you know what, yeah, we'll take the $5,000 because the advisors know. If an advisor is involved with a player who messes up a team by reneging on a deal, that's going to have consequences for the advisor going forward. So in some ways, if you had one of these gut feel guys who had an advisor, it's almost better because the advisor is going to make sure the kid signs for $5,000 if that's what he said.
The funny thing about that I think that there is a very good role for advisors and agents and all, you know, for a lot of players in the draft. I'll say this. If you're a college senior signing for $5,000, you may not need that advisor right now.
Well, you may need that advisor, though. Think about it this way, too, though. That advisor may help you get drafted in the 30th round if you haven't been picked.
Yeah.
Because at that point, it's all over the map. So I'm not saying go run out and get an advisor.
Yeah,
but,
I was going to say, because that $5,000 now has become a little less.
Well, but I mean, it's like you lose, what, $250? I mean, the advisor is going to make
it up.
The advisor's
not making a mint off this by any stretch.
Yeah, an advisor is going to probably work harder for that $250 than the $250 is worth. Because, you know, the interesting thing, not that we're going to get sidetracked talking about agents and advisors, you know, I had some people tell me, with these new pull amounts, you don't need an advisor. You know, with this draft, you actually probably need an advisor more than ever, JJ, for two reasons. One, nobody's signing for the pull amounts. You need an advisor who has a very good handle on, look, you could go with pick 18, 37, or 55, or you could go in the second round to two teams, but if you don't go there, you might go in the fifth round, to be able to pinpoint exactly what might happen and be able to tell you what, you know, the best deal might be. And two, I've had teams tell me this. The advisors who have a reputation for being easy to deal with, I'm not saying that they just roll over and give up the player, but like, you know, you can work out what you think an equitable deal is. I had teams tell me, you know, those guys, I'm going to their guys this year. You know, if there's three or four guys on the board and Agent X has one of these guys and I know I can work with that guy and I know I can call that guy and in 5 minutes hammer out a deal that makes us both happy and then I can budget further, I'm doing that. So in an odd sort of way, even though you have these strict budgets and these pools and these specific pick values, I had players and I had teams telling me I'd much rather deal with an advisor I know than deal with a guy who doesn't have an advisor at all, because that part's a little scary. And we don't need to belabor that point.
Right,
but it's just, it's almost like it became more important this year in some cases.
Now, I do want to ask you another team. We talked a little bit about the Pirates and Appel, and I guess I'll ask you, I'll put you on the spot. Do you think when it's all said and done, do you think Appel signs, or do you think Appel is, does not sign with the Pirates?
I would say I think he signs, JJ. I don't think it's a lock. I would say I would be surprised if the Pirates signed him to enough money that it cost them a future draft pick. That would surprise me more than Mark Appel not signing. I mean, at the end of the day, I think they can get that number close to four. He is advised, everybody knows he's got Scott Boras as an advisor. And the scary thing about Scott is Scott's not afraid to tell his guys, walk away, you can get more money down the road. And to Scott's credit, in a lot of cases, even when you don't think it's going to happen, Luke Kochever is a prominent example, it happens. So Mark Appel could say, look, I'm turning down four. I'll go back to Stanford. I'll go to independent ball, whatever it will be. And I think I'll go in a position where I can make more than four next year. And we'll see. I mean, I'll put it this way. You could lose a lot of money betting against Scott Boras because his guys always seem to land on their feet. My gut feel is he does sign. I'd be shocked if it's enough to give up a draft. What do you think, JJ? Do you think he signs?
I think he signs, and I think when it's all said and done, basically, again, in this case, this is under the new system, he's going to have lost a lot of money because he, there was other – if there was the possibility he could have gone one and it was down to whether you're willing to agree to it, so they know before you sign, before they pick you, well, then he lost a lot of money.
Yeah, and I'm not sure.
I don't think he's going to get, and you're right, you can often lose a lot of money betting against Scott Boras. Scott Boras is as good, and his agency is as good as anyone out there. He's an advisor, not an agent for Appel, but the advisor for Appel. That being said, I think in this case, I don't think that Mark Appel is going to get, again, the number float around there. If it was possible for him to have gotten $6 million with the Astros or something around that, I don't think that Mark Appel is going to end up getting $6 million when he signs his first pro contract.
And I think we could say this, too. I mean, the Astros have said they never offered a specific number. Scott has said, his understanding is, there was no specific number offered. I think it was more – maybe parameters were discussed.
Right.
This is the one thing we could say with certainty, though. Carlos Correa, everybody thinks he's signing for around $5 million. So the Astros, the one thing we kind of do know is the Astros are willing to go somewhere around five with that, at least somewhere around five. Well, I don't think Mark Appel is getting $5 million in this draft.
Right.
So I don't know that he turned down a specific number or even a specific parameter, but I do not think there's any way that Mark Appel is going to get more money than Carlos Correa gets or more money than Byron Buxton gets at number two.
Right. And that's what it comes down to is that this system is such, and again, I don't think – I'll be interested. In most drafts going forward, I don't think the number one pick is going to get the slot allotment because you're to be the – we've had a couple of years lately where it was interesting where there was one guy who was clearly number one. Bryce Harper probably gets the allotment. Steven Strasburg probably gets the allotment. But you have, if you're talking about the year you have a Tyone and a Machado and a couple of guys, if you have years like where – or last year where you had seven or eight guys you could love, I think that it's going to be something where the number one – the team who's got the number one pick is going to be able to play that off of each other, play it off of other players. Hey, if you don't want this right now, we can move on. And if we move on, there's enough guys out there that you could be saying goodbye to $1 or $2 million. Are you willing to risk that? And I think for once, MLB has set up a system where the teams actually do have more leverage than the players.
I think you may see people do what the Astros did. Not only if there isn't that clear guy and they can look at a number of guys as a candidate, I think you may see more teams at number one do what the Astros did, which is not engage these guys in lengthy discussions and giving them a chance like, hey, if my guy, I'm taking my guy, whether I'm trying to or not, my guy's falling out of the mix at number one, well, I better find him a home at two or three. The Astros didn't let any of those guys do that. They kind of, engaged. They said they were looking at five guys. But they didn't really negotiate or talk parameters with any of those guys until maybe an hour or two before the draft. And at that point, if you weren't, you know, they kind of had the hand on all those guys. You know, if you aren't coming here, you better have talked somewhere else and be ready to go there, or you could fall. And that's what happened to Appel.
And that's the thing that, you know, you're going to see going forward. I did want to ask about another team before we wrap here up here. The Blue Jays, I thought, had a very interesting draft because they, I'd say, I would argue as that more than any other team, they, in the top rounds, took, they had some extra picks, but they took some potentially tough signs. What did
they
you
did. Yeah, their draft fascinated me because they have an $8.8 million pool, which is more than most teams, I think.
Because they had five picks in the first and
first
supplemental first round.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. And I think, I know we've had some guys break on the senior. I think rounds 4 through 10 are all college seniors, aren't they?
Yes.
Yeah, so that's, you know, I'm looking here. I'm doing the math real quick in my head. That's about $1.2 million.
Yeah, $1.2 million.
In those rounds, and to be honest, they're probably signing those seven guys for under $50,000.
No. Wait. I can probably give you better info on that. And then John Manuel had a story up. He talked to their fourth-round pick, Tucker Donahue.
Right.
He wouldn't give them the exact number, but he said he's agreed to a deal that's in four digits.
Yeah,
so,
well, that's what I'm saying. I mean, I think those guys are all getting $5,000 apiece. Yeah, so
yeah.
I mean, you're going to have
saying,
like one.
You're saying all of them for $50,000. Okay.
Yeah, total. I'm saying combined. So you're going to have like 1-1 or 1-2 to play with. And looking at this, you know, DJ Davis, I don't know what he's going to sign for. My guess is it might be a little bit under the pool amount. You know, Marcus Stroman, who I've talked about, and I think he's still at 22. I don't know if they talked money with him. I don't think he's going to get more than that pool amount. You know, Matt Smorl's going to cost a little extra there with the 50th pick. But there's a guy who could have been a mid-first round pick if he hadn't broken a bone in his foot. So already right there, you got one of the best athletes in the draft in Davis. Maybe the guy with the most electric arm in the draft is Stroman. And Matt Smorl, who went about 35 picks lower than he had. You know, you got Mitch Ney, who was an Arizona high school third baseman who kind of rose up charts. You know, I'll be curious to see what he signs for. He may be a guy that you discount a little bit there at $885,000. You know, Tyler Gonzalez is another guy who's got, you know, one of the best arms in this draft, just electric stuff. At 60, you know, I mean, I think he's fairly signable. I mean, you're probably going to get him for around that 857 number. You know, and then you got Chase DeJong, a projectable California high school kid, you know, at 6'20". But, you know, the guy who's going to be fascinating to me, JJ, and maybe they don't sign him, and if they don't, you know, they made a run at him. But the Anthony Alford kid in the third round, I mean, he, DJ Davis, and Byron Buxton, who went number two overall, were the best athletes in the draft. Big-time Southern Miss football recruit. You know, his pool amount's 424. Now, I mean, that's not going to get it done. But this is a guy, had he been willing to sign and give up football, and he had a lot of leverage because of the football commitment, might have been a $2 million player, you know, would have probably been drafted higher. I don't know if they could pull off Anthony Alford, but to be honest, if they signed the six guys ahead of him, it's still a tremendous draft.
And now my question is that, you know, well, it'd be interesting. One thing I was a little surprised with was after the 10th round, having done all that, I didn't see a whole lot of guys listed that you would say, okay, well, that's a guy who they could end up, you know, shuffling some of that money to later. Brandon Lopez, who they took very late, maybe, I guess, could be one of those guys. But if they don't get Alford, where do you think that money goes?
I think if they don't get Alford, I mean, some of the money...
Because you're only going to lose $424,000 of that money they've socked aside for that.
Right. And the thing is, you know, Smorl's going to get some extra money, but let's say they create... Well, we just said, you know, they're probably going to create an extra $1.1, $1.2 million from rounds 4 through 10. And let's say... Smorl, I'm just pulling a number out of the air. Let's say he takes half that, so you have $600,000 to play with. I think what they probably do is, you know, they have some mid-level high school guys you sign. You know, they got one of the best Canadian players in this draft, Ryan Kellogg, in the 12th round. You know, maybe you sign him for $300,000. You got Ryan Barucki, who's one of the best players from up here in Illinois, who had elbow issues but would have been like a top 10-round pick. You know, maybe you give him $250,000. They got William DuPont in the 16th round, who's an intriguing raw athlete. You know, maybe you sign him for $300,000. You know, those types of guys. You know, they got another Canadian, Nathan D'Souza, in the 26th round. You got a Cole Irvine, who's kind of an interesting, projectable lefty from Anaheim. You know, so maybe they don't get a big splash like
they
would have with
Alford.
But
they can spread that money out.
But maybe you sign two or three of these guys for $300,000 each. And the thing I kind of like about it is, you know, they don't have that, you know, that we were talking about the Pirates. They don't have a Walker Buehler or with the Astros, Hunter Verant. They don't have a guy you're looking at like, okay, that guy's a $1 million guy. But they probably have six or seven guys here who were, you know, you might have in the old rules signed for $300,000, $500,000. And so you could pick off two or three of them, and you have enough candidates that, you know, if one guy turns it down, you can give it to another. So I think they probably spread it around in those rounds a little bit.
And do remember, one of the things with that is I wanted to point out people don't understand yet. Those guys we talked about later in the 10th round, if you give $300,000 to one of those guys, it's only cost $200,000 of your bonus pool. So that was kind of one of the things. That, to me, was the most perverse part of this draft is that spell this out in the story that's on the draft blog, but to explain it here, if you have one guy you like at $250,000 and another guy you like at $5,000, well, in the past, you would take the $250,000 guy in the fourth or fifth round, and you would take the $1,000 guy in the 25th round or whatever, the $5,000 guy. If you did that, that would cost $250,000 of your bonus allotment. Under the new system, if you reverse that and you say, okay, we're going to take the $5,000 guy in the top 10 rounds, and we're going to take the $250,000 guy in the later rounds, by doing that, you've essentially saved yourself $95,000 to $100,000 of your bonus allotment, because the first $100,000 for a post-10th rounder is essentially free to for your allotment. Which is
exactly. And as a bonus, too, if you don't sign him, you know you're signing the $5,000 guy. So you don't have to worry about his bonus pool allocation disappearing. The 11th round guy or later round guy, if I don't sign him, you know, it's a tougher sign, then that bonus money, you know, dies away. And just to clarify, in case, because I know these rules are confusing for a lot of our listeners, there was no bonus pool previously. If you want to pay a guy $250,000, it really didn't matter if you paid him that in round 6 or round 32. You know, if MLB might tell you not to do it, but there was no budget. You had to fit him in or you'd lose draft picks. You would just get MLB angry at you. Now, there's a very specific reason for doing this, And I talked to teams. I mean, I thought some teams would do this, JJ, before the draft, that you'd have some teams picking some college seniors in round 6 through 10. I didn't see 57 seniors going around 6 through 10. I didn't think you'd see some teams. I thought you might see a team maybe take 4 college seniors around 6 through 10. But you had like 5 or 6 teams that pretty much went all college seniors there to save, $700,000,
$800,000. Yeah, and that's – we had one of our interns, Clint Longenecker, worked it up. 57, I think, this year. And in if you look back at the last 4 or 5 years before that, the average was 30. So that just gives you an idea of, of how different it was this year. And I have to admit, taking you behind the curtain here, a little frustrating for us here at Baseball America, because we pride ourselves on you're going to have a scouting report for everyone in the top 10 rounds, hopefully, ideally, as the guys picked. There were some guys taken who, weren't top 10 round talents, and so it's a little tougher to have scouting reports on some of those guys. And so we've had to do a little scrambling to kind of fill that in. Now, on the flip side, we've had a lot more scouting reports on guys taken after the 10th round because there was more of those guys who fell, which is, maybe too much behind the curtain, but that's been kind of an interesting part of this for us.
I was proud. I'm going to brag here a little bit that I sometimes wonder if I dig too deep before the draft, does it really matter to, have stuff? I'm proud to say there were only two guys out of my Midwest region that I had to go ahead and make a call to find information on, that at least I had information on most of my guys who kind of came out of nowhere. So I took a little pride on that, JJ, on draft day or on the second day of the draft, that I wasn't scrambling as much as I might have had to otherwise.
I will say there were a couple other guys who were scrambling, but they were calling on guys and they were hearing from scouts like, that guy? Really? That guy was taken? We didn't turn that guy in at all. He doesn't have anything plus, and things like that. But the last count for our listeners, the last count we were sitting at 602 scouting reports for players who were drafted. So pretty much no matter what team you're a fan of, we're going to have scouting reports on most all of the guys who were taken for your – not most. We have scouting reports for roughly 50% of everyone who was taken. So
what's interesting to me too, JJ, is I was looking at the BA 500. I didn't count up the exact number, We I think there's about 100 players out of the BA 500 who didn't get drafted. Most of them high schoolers who just got priced out of the draft.
Yeah, the interesting thing, this is one of the great things about the BA 500, which this is the first year we've had it like this. Yeah, if you click on undrafted, you know, players from and see, you know, where they rank on there. The interesting thing is there are a couple of college guys on there too, which generally the college guys who went undrafted, pretty much what it comes down to is they largely comes down to that they were injured. And
right.
So teams weren't willing to take a pick on, you know, which is still, though, it's interesting to me because the high school guys, pretty much you can explain with that is, okay, well, that guy, it wasn't going to be worth the pick because he wasn't signing.
Right.
But you have Christian Jones was number 315, a left-hander from Oregon. There's injury issues there. You have, you know, you go a little further, you have
Michael Rattery at Rice is our next guy, and there you have the issue where it's a good school, he had a bad year, and he wasn't just going to sign for $100,000 and give up his last year at Rice.
Right. And then you're talking guys in the 400s where, again, it comes down to, you know, I'll be interested to see, like, I was entering around a draft round yesterday, and it's like, there was a Yale catcher taken in the late rounds, and I'm thinking, yeah, that guy's probably not going to sign. I'm going to guess that he might have some other opportunities that may pay him a little bit more than the $5,000 bonus he's going to get.
Yeah, but, I mean, unless he's a senior, in which case he might. But, yeah, I mean, you're not going to sign a Yale junior for less than that.
You know, but, well, we've been going on for about an hour here, and someone is very insistently trying to reach Jim, so we're going to wrap
it's actually multiple people. I'm getting, like, three different phone calls here in the last 5 minutes, so.
So, but thanks for the time, Jim. Thanks for the download, all of our listeners. We want to thanks again Dick's Sporting Goods, which sponsors all of our draft coverage this year. We've got at least a day before we start looking ahead to the 2013 draft. The reality also is we got to start working on futures game rosters to help out MLB and all coming up with that and all. So it never stops.
No, it never does. But at least we can kind of catch our breath at least over the weekend, hopefully.
Hopefully. And we've also, of course, got college super regionals going on this weekend. And then Omaha comes up. But this is a great time of year. We love this kind of stuff. So thanks for the download. Thanks for all the kind things on our Twitter feed that people said about our draft coverage and all. We thank you all for all that. We enjoy doing it. And we'll be back again soon. Thanks again.